Hello and a very warm welcome to the EMG Health Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. I'm joined today by a very special guest, entrepreneur, founder, and CEO of Thor Photo Medicine, James Carroll. We met a number of years ago chatting on a plane, and I was immediately fascinated by what he was, and still is, up to. James and I will, if you'll forgive me, be bringing light into your life, specifically about the design, manufacturing, deployment, and research of devices to deliver photobiomodulation, also known as PBM. It's a bit of less of a mouthful. Thor Photo Medicine is a revolutionary United Kingdom biotech company that conducts research, develops medical lasers, and then teaches healthcare practitioners around the world how to use them. Largely, it's James doing that. Thor's equipment has delivered more than 30 million treatments across the globe, and science is catching on to the fact that PBM is real and here to stay, but many are still unaware of what it can do, so maybe today we can go some way to changing that. And we're in safe hands since James has co-authored numerous learned papers on PBM, contributed chapters to several books, and co-chairs the annual Biomedical Optics Society conference on PBM mechanisms. He's also a fellow at the Royal Society of Medicine, as well as a board member at both the World Association for PBM and the North American Association for Laser Therapy. So without further ado, let's dive in and find out more about James and PBM. Welcome, James.
Thank you, Jonathan.
So, many people who are medical visionaries, entrepreneurs, tend to have non-traditional backgrounds. Tell us about your early years. You were challenged growing up with dyslexia and left school quite young, 16, I believe.
It's all true. It's a self-diagnosis. I'm not sure if they'd even invented dyslexia back in the 60s. And first, I should say, I have excellent parents. And I was first born of four children, and we were surrounded by books. And I was reading out loud to them at an early age. I mean, under duress, but I was reading out loud to them. But around about 6 years old, I was sent for private handwriting tuition each week. That was unsatisfactory for me and for them and for my parents, and I believe that was abandoned. And around the age of eight, I was sent on an educational psychologist several times, and I know he became exasperated. I just remember the last time, he was ended up shouting at me, as I recall.
I don't know.
I was like 8 years old at the time. I think I'd said something like, he said, you know, why are you coming here? Why is this doing anything for you? Is anything getting? I was like, no, I don't think so. And I must have said it in a condescending way. He didn't like my response anyway, whatever it was. And then around 10 years old, I should say that in between about nine, I had figured out by now, my experience of school and teachers was that teachers were stupid because they didn't understand my questions. And that was frustrating. And you just shut up and you move to the corner of the back corner of the room and you just don't participate. And there was no point. I was more humiliated by my asking questions rather than enlightened by that experience. And I remember overhearing my parents when I was about 10, discussing a new school that I was going to be attending as my father was moving a job to a new county. And they were relieved that I wasn't going to have to do the 11 plus exam, if you remember that, of course.
Oh, yes, I do, yeah.
And if, for your non-UK listeners, it's an entrance exam for grammar schools because back in the 60s and early 70s, we had a two-tier educational system. And after the age of 11, you either went one way or the other. You went to grammar school for the smart kids, or you went to secondary school for the not so smart if you didn't pass your 11 plus, and so ruins your chances of getting a profession really or going to university. And so my parents believed I wasn't going to get through the 11 plus. I wouldn't get to grammar school. I wouldn't become a bank manager, which or whatever it is they wanted me to become. And so it was the new comprehensive system, which had a group, what do you call it, streams of A, B, and C, A for the smart, B for the not so smart, which is where I ended up, and C for the delinquent, really. I think it was they were pretty much written off if you were on C grade. So I was on a track to get a blue-collar job, really.
Yeah, when in fact, of course, those are the kids that need the most help, right?
Yeah, and it's well known, as you as you said in your introduction, I mean, there's many, either not just entrepreneurs, but apparently it is one of the most frequent sort of like disabilities. If you ever read the book by Malcolm Gladwell and the outliers and one of the features of a successful person is that they overcome a disability. And the number one disability people learn to at least cope with is dyslexia. So like famously Richard Branson, for example.
And of course, there's that lovely quote by Mark Twain that I think it was Mark Twain. I never let school get in the way of my education. And you've certainly been very well educated. So you left school at 16?
Yes, I knew. I mean, I was in a band and I was making fuzz boxes. As, you know, as a teenager. And
I'm sorry, what's a fuzz box?
A fuzz box is an effects pedal or an effects.
Oh, right, with a guitar.
With a guitar, that's right. So we made all sorts of things, my friends and I. So, you know, I was doing electronics as a young teenager. I knew I wanted to get into audio electronics. I knew that I would like to be in broadcast. And I just finished my exams. I didn't actually even wait for the results. I certainly didn't even go and collect them at any point. And I knew I didn't do well. Ultimately, by the way, I did find it. I got one O-level and I got four or five low-grade CSEs.
Right.
My one O-level, which was in physics. So,
well, I mean, that's sort of pointing towards where your future was. So you mentioned a band. I remember we talked about it quite a while back, and you went on to become BBC's Young Entertainers of the Year. Tell us about that adventure. Why it ended?
Well, I was brought up in a musical household. I think music's always been part of my life and still is today, at least in terms of listening to it, not playing it. And my father was very musical. I was in every school choir, that kind of thing. And my friend, who we made fuzz boxes with and things and played with amplifiers, Gavin and I would make up songs in his bedroom and record it on an old quarter-inch reel-to-reel tape machine and Philips cassette tapes. And about 1974, his mother applied for us both to appear on a BBC talent show called Hey Look, That's Me, which is just BBC One in the South. And, you know, you go to an audition and we get on, invited onto the show and we do our thing. And they also asked us to make the signature tune for the show. And having done that, we were then joined by a drummer and Simon, and then my sister entered us for an audition for the BBC Young Entertainers of the Year competition, which was part of the TV show you will recall, Cracker Jack. So we got selected to be on TV for that. We made it through to the semi-finals, we made it through to the finals, and we won the finals, and we walked out with this award, which was just record players and music and records, that kind of a thing. And it's not that we were particularly talented, but the one thing we did well is we played well together. We were definitely a team. We were well aligned. We were well in tune. We were very, intuitive players. We could jam and we just made a good sound. It wasn't technically good in terms of our accomplishment on instruments, but we just played well together.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of rock music, certainly, it's just a few chords. And, you know, the Rolling Stones, the whole thing that they're a garage band, they've done pretty well. What genre of music was it?
Well, we were kind of living. You start with the old stuff with like Elvis Presley, for example, and we were doing a lot of. We did a lot of gigs, and we played at PTAs, you know, Parent Teacher Association groups. So it was Elvis. It would have been Bill Haley, Rock Around the Clock, that kind of thing. Those are 50s kind of numbers. It's Beatles. Those are complex chords. But what we were really playing for our own entertainment would be Status Quo and that kind of thing. So teeny bopper, kind of pop rock kind of music. At that time, Mud and Shawaddy Waddy and that kind of thing from the mid-70s.
Oh, wonderful. And what happened?
A recurring theme throughout my life has been my father's progression up the greasy pole of corporate life. And every 2 years, we moved to a new location. And even though we'd been in Bognor Regis at that time for about 5 years, I think, it's the longest I've ever sat still. We were off and he was moving hundreds of miles away and the band really couldn't keep it together after that. So that's what happened. My parents moved and we're still a young teenager, 15 at the time, and that's it. The band it could no longer play as a band anymore. So
what was the name of the band?
Oh, please. It's the Rockettes. The Rockettes, exactly the same as that glamorous American dance troupe in New York.
Yeah, absolutely. Without the high kicking legs. So, I'm sure lots of people will be going online and seeing if they can find some of your music.
I'm afraid they might, yes. On YouTube. That's embarrassing.
I actually did backing vocals on a song many, many years ago, and I tell people, God knows why, because I cannot sing, but I had a friend in the business, and I tell people that the single wasn't released, it escaped. But moving on, your first entrepreneurial venture, there was a story behind that. It was involving car restoration.
Yes, that's right. So restoring old sports and classic cars, sort of TR2s, 3s, 4s, TR5, but very, very much Triumphs, but MGs, MGB, GTs, MGAs, MGCs, did Aston Martins, we did some other old cars like Bristol and things like that.
Oh, wow.
I've done a 6-year apprenticeship in electronics at a company that made audio mixers for radio stations and primarily the BBC. So I'd learned, my way around electronics and things. I met a guy in a pub. He said, I've got these old cars. I don't know one end of a wire from another, and I don't have any diagrams. Could you come and see if you can make, rewire a car? And of course, that'll be easy. So I did that, and I did that for months at weekends for him. He said, would you like to come and join me? Work here? And I said, only if you give me half the business. He said no, but eventually after some months he gave in and said, okay, you can have half the business. And off we went. I was good at tuning motorbikes because that was my thing at the time, so I was soon learned how to tune old sports cars, and that went great until it didn't, and it went up in flames, unfortunately. A welder working underneath an old Austin Healey drained the fuel from the tank, was in the process of draining the fuel from the tank, and then it was a very cold day, and the fumes just hit the floor, and for reasons we don't know, whoosh, up goes the car with the welder underneath. He wasn't welding at the time, he's just draining the tank. I dragged him out on he was on fire. I had to cover him in rags, dust sheet, other cars. The tank's on fire, the fuel's sort of flowing everywhere. We run out the back through past all the paint store, and that goes up. The office settling goes up, and we take out the whole of our workshops, the neighboring car showroom next door, and the filling station was out the back for petrol, gasoline, out the other side as well. So we had a lot of fire engines, and I made the news again for the wrong reasons.
Oh, geez. So that was the end of that business.
Yes, it was.
So what did you learn from that, other than, fuel and fire don't mix? What business?
Well, immediate business thing. I mean, there are multiple things you learn. I mean, obviously, I learned a lot about cars and paintwork. I mean, you did a gorgeous job of putting cellulose paint on old sports cars and rubbing your fingers to the bone, and that was a hard lesson. And bleeding fingers was the thing when you're flatting paintwork off. But I suppose the business lesson, just two business lessons. One is I discovered what a loss adjuster is when it comes to insurance, and we were underinsured, and he says, well, I'm afraid you haven't really insured yourself enough for your business. But you've only given half as much premium as you need. And we say, well, that's okay, because we managed to rescue those cars over there. So just pay us for the half, just give us half the money for the other bit. He said, no, I didn't insure the burnt down half of the business. I insured those cars that you rescued.
Oh,
and that's my lesson. That's how it works. That's how loss adjusters work. And that was my first lesson in that. The other thing I learned, when you've got your own business and your own, you're making your own wages, and being a bit of a perfectionist, and I would happily have spent, 6 months restoring one car, but you've got to get these things finished or you don't get paid. And I learned that it's not enough. You're not there just to make gorgeous motor cars or restore gorgeous motor cars. You're also there, you've got to make a living at it too. And so you begin to learn about the practicalities and getting things done. Getting things finished is important. So, we're not just there to make beautiful cars. We were there to also make a living.
Well, let's move on to what you do now, what's consumed your life with joy for many years. I'm very interested in the concept of the brain changing neuroplasticity and using energy either implanted or delivered in a non-implantable manner, neuromodulation. But people normally think of electricity playing that role. Well, it's about the scientific basis for photobiomodulation using light to induce neuroplasticity.
Well, all that electricity probably needs a lot of ATP. And so in the brain, particularly where we use a lot of ATP, obviously adenosine triphosphate, the cellular energy currency of the cell, comes from mitochondria. And mitochondria, you have hundreds and thousands of mitochondria in every single cell of the body. And the job of it normally is to take up glucose and take up oxygen and eventually end up combining the two, truly speak, and make energy, ATP. That's the output of mitochondria, as well as some waste product as well. My brain uses a lot of it. And it seems that as we get old, or as we get sick, as we get stressed, or particularly under ischemia, mitochondria start to become dysfunctional. They start to make up a molecule called nitric oxide, which is known. People here think they know what nitric oxide is, and they do, but they probably don't appreciate that there's four different sources. They may hear about inducible nitric oxide synthase, neuronal nitric oxide synthase, endothelial nitric oxide synthase, but what they don't hear about is mitochondrial nitric oxide synthase, partly because nobody's found it. We just know that mitochondria under stress make nitric oxide. And if you looked up the work of Salvador Moncada, he has demonstrated that nitric oxide regulates the consumption of oxygen. So if, for those of your audience who've learned about mitochondria and you know about glycolysis, and you understand the Krebs cycle, then the electron transport chain and the terminal enzyme of the electron transport chain is a protein called cytochrome C oxidase, also known as complex 4. And that is light absorbing in the red and the near infrared part of the spectrum. But it's also where nitric oxide binds to it. And it basically, normally cytochrome C oxidase is taking up oxygen. Oxygen's grabbing electrons off the end of the electron transport chain, effectively pulling them or allowing electron flow to occur. And then you make lots of hydrogen ions that drive ATP synthase, that makes ATP. But all of that stops when it's sick, injured, stressed, hypoxic tissues. Nitric oxide blocks cytochrome C oxidase, stops oxygen consumption, you stop making ATP, and that's when the bad stuff happens. It's all those electrons in the electron transport chain, which are no longer flowing, start to become reactive oxygen species like superoxide and hydrogen peroxide, and they are what start inflammation, cell death. They trigger genetic weaknesses for Alzheimer's or whatever, or Parkinson's or osteoarthritis, macular degeneration. You know, your degenerative diseases start as a result of this oxidative stress due to a constipated electron transport chain. And this light that we make is absorbed by cytochrome C oxidase. It kicks out nitric oxide. It allows oxygen to come back in again. You make hydrogen ions that drive ATP synthase. You make ATP, and the cause of all those free radicals, those reactive oxygen species that lead to oxidative stress and all those cytokines that lead to all the inflammation, that whole process stops. And you've got all this ATP, and particularly in the brain, which uses a lot of energy, a lot of ATP, you then have this improvement in brain-derived neurotrophic factors, so BDNF and BRDU. You get this neurogenesis and synaptogenesis. And things tend to heal more quickly and function better when you've got more energy and less oxidative stress. And if that's the only thing your listeners understand or remember, yes, this light increases energy, ATP, reduces oxidative stress. You end up with less microglia in your brain, less astrocytes, leading to all these degenerative brain diseases. And you end up with more BDNF, more BRDU, neurogenesis, synaptogenesis. And off you go. Things get better.
And just to be clear, and you don't need to drill down into the references, but people who are not familiar with this space may not know that there's actually a wealth of literature on this, right?
Yes,
basic science as well as clinical science.
So across the board of photobiomodulation, because you know, if you think about what kind of disease or injury, what kind of pathologies could do with a bit more ATP and a bit less oxidative stress, and it's a huge choice. It's most things probably. So the trying to remember what your question was.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's come at it a different way. So whenever you've got a drug or a technology that looks like it does many things, the standard approach that people have is that it's all probably placebo.
Yes. But,
if you look at humble old aspirin, it relieves pain, it interferes with blood clotting, it prevents second heart attacks and strokes, may prevent Alzheimer's, and stops colonic adenomas from becoming malignant. So put PBM into that conversation, James.
Well, as a field, there's a, because we do a wide range, not just the brain, but in the soft tissues as well, organs and the visceral organs of the body. There's more than 700 randomized placebo-controlled clinical trials published on this field. There's several thousand laboratory studies looking at the mechanism of action and the dose response. It's in hundreds of systematic reviews with meta-analyses. And overall, there's more than 7,000 academic papers published on this topic. And it's published in journals you've heard of, like BMJ and The Lancet and the like.
So given that wealth of experience, and I do want to in a bit drill down into specific use case scenarios, specific diseases, but from your position, having been involved in this field for many years, given that wealth of evidence, and I know you to be a very serious, although a very funny, but a very serious guy about the science, why is it not more widely accepted?
Because it's done by academics. A lot of PhD students are studying this field. There are no wealthy companies in this field. And they know that you've got to, having done the basic science work and proved a mechanism and perhaps do some, you know, got some interesting cases, some case series, and maybe some pilot studies, and they see there's something here. They know how to fund a large multi-center clinical trial, probably going through a contract research organization, and they will first of all be speaking to either FDA and go through the pre-submission process and learn what the FDA think of this, and will adjust their trials according to the wishes of the FDA in terms of primary outcome measures and statistical, suitably powered. And then with you can talk to NICE before you do a clinical trial and make sure you do the kind of clinical trial they are interested in. And then having demonstrated that, you make sure that there's reimbursement. There's obviously the money that flows through the National Health Service, not from the patient, but within an internal market and in the United States, private medical insurance. And you speak to them as well. And you make sure that you do your trials that are going to make FDA, NICE in the UK, and the reimbursement system of the National Health Service and the private medical insurance, that they're all going to fund this once you've finished your clinical trial. Academics, it baffles me that I didn't know it, but they didn't know it either. They love doing these studies and they think they're saving the world. They have no idea that if you haven't spoken to FDA or NICE in advance and do the kind of trial that they want to see and speak to the insurance companies, then or the NHS reimbursement system, it ain't going to happen. And guess what? It doesn't. Yeah, so that's the road I'm on now, as I'm learning that roadmap, is how you actually commercialize something which has got an awful lot of data behind it.
Yeah, you know, you can go to FDA with heaps of data and they'll say, well, it's fascinating, but you didn't come and talk to us.
Yes, absolutely. And had we don't use that diagnostic thing.
Exactly. Oh, so it's highly referenced. Lots of other people use it. Yeah, but we don't. So, exactly. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, the role that health economics plays in Britain for those overseas, we have the National Institutes of Clinical Excellence, NICE, which uses a mechanism called the Quality Adjusted Life Year. And it works out how much a year of quality life is, quote, worth, end quote, and then evaluates a drug or a device and its impact on that quality of life. And you've got to get the health economics done. It's just a reality. We can bitch and moan about it, but you know, America is spending 18-19% of gross domestic product on healthcare, and we're going to run out of money.
Yes. So,
given that you've got a therapy, and we want to drill down into some specifics, in each of these cases, tell us why it's better than the alternative. So let's start with musculoskeletal applications.
Well, why it's better, first of all, we're not using drugs. We're not using, you know, the downsides of using non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. If they're used for too long, they can even slow down healing in tissues and tendons and the like. And so some people will also have gastrointestinal problems to non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So obviously drug therapies, and also you don't need me to, your audience doesn't need to talk to them about acetaminophen as well as another possible problem, and opioids, opioid use disorder, and corticosteroids as well. Wonderful in the short term, terrible in the long term for musculoskeletal problems. So there's a downside for definitely for using drug therapies. So this treatment is highly anti-inflammatory, and when used at a certain dose, it's analgesic. And it's regenerative, so a deliberate overdose, and if you say overdose is a strong word, it's a better thing, but a deliberate high-dose treatment, instead of increasing ATP, can reduce ATP production. And if you use that strategically over nerves supplying an area, then you can reduce fast axonal flow and amplitude in C-fibers and A-deltas, and you get this analgesic action coming from it. And then if you treat locally over a pathology, you increase ATP, and then edema seems to flow away quickly as well. All this nitric oxide release causes vasodilation. It causes dilation of lymph vessels as well. Edema goes down quickly. Inflammation gets taken away by the lymphatic system. And you stop reduced inflammation through the reduction of oxidative stress down the NF-kappa-B pathway, and that's getting nerdy again. So we have this anti-inflammatory effect, and then you get all these regenerative effects, and all these, you know, fibroblasts come in and make more collagen, and macrophages take debris away and release growth factors and the like, and tissues just heal more quickly. That's a huge advantage, and in terms of no drugs, and as was identified in a systematic review and meta-analysis in the BMJ, a year ago for osteoarthritis of the knee, the effects last longer than those of drugs. You do a course of treatment, and once you stop treatment, the benefits continue to get better afterwards. And we're getting, I'm told that non-steroidals get you 7 to 14 millimeters of pain relief is the mean score. We're getting 30% reduction in pain in osteoarthritis, and the effects last longer than non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs as well.
And apparently really good for neck pain, right?
And yes, so that's a reviewed, a systematic review, meta-analysis again in The Lancet. And then, you know, as the reviewers rightly noted in that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs don't work on neck pain. There is no inflammation really in neck pain for most people. What's really going on is it's neuromuscular, really. It's myofascial in its component. Again, using that strategic higher dose treatment, it seems to cause the relaxation of these motor end plates just sort of let go, the muscles relax, and all of a sudden people can turn their heads some more. So drugs don't touch that kind of pain, this neuromuscular or myofascial pain. This treatment does. You hit those points, and we have a diagnostic gadget which finds it. You move the probe across the patient's trapezius, scalenes, sternocleidomastoid, wherever it is, if you're going up to TMJ. But you treat these trigger points that you can find electrically, put the laser on it, and boof, it goes, and it's instant. It happens there and then in front of your eyes. And people who could barely turn their heads 1 minute can suddenly start looking over their shoulders again and sleep better.
Well,
and they do need multiple treatments before you ask. The one treatment's good for a few days, but if you want lasting thing, you're going to need a course of a good 10 treatments.
Right. Well, we're going to come on to how you deploy it in a little bit, but I want to rack up a few other examples, first of all. So from neck and other musculoskeletal pain, let's go to something really surprising. Oral mucositis. Tell us.
Well, enzinitis. It's enzinitis, implies inflammation. So all the itises are a target for this treatment. So oral mucositis is a side effect of high dose chemotherapy or high dose radiotherapy, particularly in head and neck cancer patients. And yes, you lose all the lining in your mouth, through down through your oral pharynx, esophagus, and potentially down to your anus. If you're a bone marrow transplant patient, you get it really severely like this. And we apply this treatment. Traditionally, well, the early discoverers, you apply intraorally, applying a sort of a light guide, a laser down a light guide goes into the mouth and treats multiple points inside the mouth and the tongue, soft palates and ventral tongue, and down to the floor of the mouth to get to all these points inside the labial tissues to reduce this inflammation. We now make a light emitting lollipop you put inside your mouth that treats the whole oral cavity in one go. We do some extra oral treatments with it, so going through the cheeks to get light to the buccal tissues. And now it's a recommended treatment on NICE, National Institute of Health and Care Excellence. And it's now being reimbursed in the United States. Or at least the insurance companies are saying they accept it's medically necessary. The Multinational Association for Supportive Care and Cancer recommend this treatment as well. So that's you know, we're on the way with that. So that's, it's on its way. And you, I'll take the opportunity to say something now in case it doesn't come up as a question. My goal is to establish photobiomodulation as a first-line medical treatment for 100 different diseases in 100 different countries by the time I'm 100 years old, which is 2062. And oral mucositis is the front runner at the moment for that. And number two is going to be macular degeneration.
Well, let's go. I mean, I love your goals and I love your approach to life, James. Tell us about macular degeneration. I mean, wet and dry, nasty diseases, blindness mm-hmm. is a huge problem. Very little to offer these patients, really. Actually, nothing.
Yeah, well, nothing on the dry form, certainly. The wet form, yes, you can have injections to slow progression. There's no proven successful treatment for the dry form. So I'm a disclosure, I'm also an investor and co-founder of Lumithera. We've raised $30 million so far. We've finished pilot studies and we're in a multi-center, multinational clinical trials in 16 centers around Europe and the United States at the moment. We've shown in our pilot study that we get 5 letters of improvement on the Snellen chart. So that's effectively one line of improvement. In dry AMD patients, which 90% of AMD patients have the dry form, this is the leading cause of blindness in the developed world. Nothing really successful has been found for it. And now here we are. We're improving visual acuity. It doesn't last for more than 6 months. In fact, it goes very much into decline. You regresses, but another treatment 6 months seems to bring it back again and you get your vision back. So you will need treatment for the rest of your life. And again, it's another inflammatory condition. And yeah, we treat the inflammation and all of a sudden people get clearer vision. That's only true for the earlier stage patients. If you've already got necrosis, then it's not so good. You get slower progress with those patients. You probably won't gain as much as you would if you get it early enough. But at the later stage, still an improvement and stops it getting worse. And as you say, it's horrible for the quality of life because you can't read, you can't drive, you can't go shopping, you can't enjoy TV. The hit on quality of life is huge. And it costs the health service a huge amount as well to look after these people, particularly if they're, you know, they lose independent living.
So you've talked about musculoskeletal problems, which affect a huge number of people and are, I believe, one of the leading causes of time off work. Oral mucositis, you know, you've had to deal with the emotional blow of a cancer diagnosis, and now you have this awful symptom. And I, in fact, know two folks who've gone through this, and it was debilitating because they can't eat and drink. And now, of course, macular degeneration. So these are three huge leaps. But let's get away from a scientific basis and dig down. I know you're a big fan of properly conducted research, peer-reviewed publications, but as clinicians, and our audience is largely clinicians, we love patient stories. So you've seen your technology deployed to treat numerous people from football players to royalty. We don't want you to breach confidentiality, of course, but you must have a story or two to tell.
More than I can possibly remember, and I know I keep a little blog page going where I actually start to link to them all because I forget them all myself, and I know there's 90 videos up there of testimonials from patients talking about how life was before and how life was afterwards. So one of the just most recent kind of ones coming to mind, a podiatrist had a patient who's a diabetic patient. You know, they have poor peripheral blood flow. They develop these ulcers and it can ultimately end in amputation. And just such a patient who'd already had a toe amputated was with this podiatrist who acquired our product, started doing the treatment and was scheduled for surgery. The wound started to heal. They postponed the surgery and ultimately it's now cancelled. This patient has had the diabetic wounds healed and no longer needs to go for surgery to have her foot removed. So that's not unique. That is a very common story, stories like that. And many years ago, myself and the head of tissue viability for Scotland, Lydia Jacks, and along with Mary Dyson, she's one of the four main editors of Grey's Anatomy and was reader in tissue repair at Guy's Hospital. We went together, went up to Scotland to speak to Lydia's tissue viability nurse crowd. She had 200 nurses who under her wing, and she said, look at this wonderful thing I'm using. Here's some of my cases. Here's James Carroll from the company. Here is Mary Dyson from Grey's Anatomy, who's going to talk about it from an academic point of view. We did this great presentation, and I thought, that's great. Every tissue viability and clinical nurse specialist is going to buy a laser, and they didn't. Not a single person bought one for their department. They just referred all their patients to Lydia because she had the magic wand. So that's what happened, unfortunately. And then, but that's a diabetic wound story. There's so many. Another one I want to mention is a girl who had a stroke at birth, at the age of 9 years old, goes to one of our customer treatment centers, had a course of treatment. She tells very sad stories of how she was excluded at school, how she was bullied, how she really was, she had a lot of problems of speaking and physical function. Life was miserable. She then commenced some treatment, as her mother brought her for this treatment. And now she's dancing and talking. She presents very nicely to camera. She's not perfect for a nine-year-old girl in terms of function but and cognitive abilities. But a tear-jerking video on my blog page, if you want to track that one down.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, again, look, I know you love to teach, and having seen you lecture, I can attest that you're an excellent speaker. So what gives you the biggest buzz when you're presenting to an audience about a photobiomodulation?
I don't get a bit of that. I love the preparation, because I know there's going to be medical professors sitting in the front row with their arms crossed, not going to believe a word they hear to start with. And I love being prepared, preparing for that, and tuning my brain so I can articulate what it is that we do, and not making a mistake. So I like making sure I've got good evidence-based data for them. I love doing that, getting it right, and them enjoying it, and then wanting to meet afterwards, and you know me, go for dinner and stuff, and have a good chat. So I love the post sort of conference or the inter-conference sort of social sessions. That's a great time. And having given a presentation that went over well, then I love the bit that's afterwards, really. That's what I like the most.
Well, I've always enjoyed you. You do this thing, and I know it's a podcast and people can't see it, but you begin with this very, very fanciful description of what you make. And I'm going to ask you to tell people in a second, but it comes across as, oh my God, really? And then you deconstruct it and do so in a brilliant manner. But tell the listeners.
Yes, when anybody says to me, so what do you do? And I say, have you seen Star Trek? And I wait for them to nod. And I say, well, you know, on Star Trek, when somebody gets injured and they go to the sick bay, the doctor gets out a laser beam, aims the laser at the injury, and the injuries heal. The tissues regenerate instantly. Well, we make those.
And I love it. I love it. It always gets a laugh.
That's fine. And I have to explain that it's not as fast as on TV. But yeah. You get the idea. You shine light on people and they get better more quickly.
Yeah.
And that's the key thing, the takeaway message from all of this is this isn't just a form of pain relief. The reason this works so well is really ultimately it helps people heal.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it does. Yeah. In a way that drugs and surgeries don't.
Yeah, and you know, it's again, it's going back to the aspirin story. We now have an understanding of why aspirin does that. It's working at a very basic level. You're sort of, and you're doing the same thing by affecting the inflammatory process. Now, going on with speaking, I know that you've spoken at events recently, in the recent past, about the opioid crisis, including in front of the United Nations, White House, congressional briefings. Tell us about that. I mean, obviously, everyone knows about the opioid crisis, but what role do you play in this?
Well, first of all, to say you know as well as anybody, it's who you know. So you got me the gig at the UN at that Global Impact Forum that you were part of organizing. So that's kind of how we've went on to.
I wasn't trying to plug myself, Jane. But thank you. Yes. I mean, my goal was to find the very best speakers, and I did that.
And again, who you know gets you into places like the Congress. And it's doing and having those videos that it does help add weight. I mean, people love, say they want to see research, and then, as you rightly said, people like to know some cases as well. And just adding, you know, having a video on the front of my website with the United Nations presentation and the also the Congress and a few other things, it just adds more weight. And it sounds like, well, the data's there and the cases seem interesting. And he seems to be able to get these gigs at UN and that Congress and things. There must be something to this, surely. So it's just another reference point for me. So they have huge value from that point. It just adds, it's reputation by association, really. That's what it does, I think. So, and as for the opioid crisis, before COVID, then the world was very worried about the opioid use disorder. And so there's the psychiatric department of Harvard Medical School have shown that when you put light on the brain, just a single treatment reduces the results on the opioid craving scale, OCS scale. So we know one treatment helps. Multiple treatments would be part of a long-term therapy for those people. We are definitely, and we've got evidence for how treatment reduces the use of opioids in cancer patients who have oral mucositis, for example, but in after surgery as well. This can be bone surgery. It can be just oral surgery. Open cholecystectomies is my first one I ever saw on this. Dramatic reductions in the use of opioids. So reducing use and also the actually treating the brain itself as part of a therapy help people reduce cravings. That's what I want to get back to once this opioid, this COVID thing's out of the way.
Yeah, I was actually chatting with a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist who is dedicated to treating adolescents with drug addictions, and actually was telling him that we were going to be chatting. So I've got an introduction to make. Tell me, James, right. You've expressed your desire for 100 diseases. You know, by the time you're 100, right?
Yep.
Where is PBM going to go in the future? What are your hopes for the technology with a little bit more granularity than that?
It's going to be in every corner of every department of every hospital in the whole world. That's where it's going. This is the horrible thing. I'm glad to keep referencing aspirin as an example. It's basically what diseases or injuries need a bit more ATP and a bit less oxidative stress with some blood flow and lymphatic flow. This combination of things it dramatically reduces edema and pain and post-operative wounds, and then they heal better with less scarring. So any operative situation, but then we started off talking about the brain, reducing inflammation and creating ATP in the brain is a good thing. And then you get this regenerative effects going on. So it's going to be in the brain. It's going to be in internal organs. There have been experiments on, you know, on the liver, acute kidney disease. People are treating degenerative diseases of the brain as well as traumatic injuries of the brain. The whole body, musculoskeletal pain we've talked about, neuropathic pain. Things just seem to regenerate, just like on Star Trek, but just more slowly. And who wouldn't want that in every corner of every department of every hospital in the whole world?
I don't think that we can top that. James Carroll, you are a true citizen scientist. I'm proud to call you friend and colleague. You've been unconstrained by a more conventional route to medical advances, and I think that allows you to see things more clearly. And if, you know, there's the expression to be on the bleeding edge, you sure as heck are. I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today and share your wisdom and wit and stories. And over the next, 42 years, hope we can have you back.
Absolutely.
So that's it for this week on the EMG Health Podcast. But please tune in again next week and every Friday for more episodes with more inspiring guests. Take care and bye for now.